This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Dr. Claire Brennan is a lecturer in history at James Cook University and joins us today. Hello, Claire.
Hello.
Hey, Claire, firstly, should we draw a distinction between, or can we talk about the difference between subsistence hunting and recreational or sport hunting?
I think we can, and certainly historically we can. And there are other types of hunting too that are worth considering. So as you say, there's subsistence hunting where people have hunting as a way of eating, essentially. It's just part of how they get their living. And then sport hunting is where people hunt because they enjoy it or they get something important out of it. But there are other types as well. So there's also survival hunting, where you hunt because you're desperate and it's the only way you're going to eat. And there's commercial hunting, where hunting is not just something you do to supplement your income, but it is your actual income. So there are these different types of hunting, and they've all been in play in Australia at different times in the past.
What is it, and we'll get to the history of it in a minute, but what is it considered if you hunt feral animals? Is that for sport, or is that for environmental reasons?
There can be a whole lot of motives for hunting feral animals. Sometimes hunting feral animals is commercial hunting because there might be a bounty on them, or because there are other products that you can take from them and sell. Sometimes it's subsistence hunting because you just want a bit of that animal to eat. And sometimes it's sport hunting. And a lot of feral animal hunting is sport hunting, all those types mixed together. So it's not simply that people hunt for one reason or another. It's that hunting is this complex thing that people do. And there are a whole lot of motives going towards it.
We should also note that with Indigenous cultures in Australia, there's been hunting for tens of thousands of years.
Oh, yeah, there's been hunting in Australia as long as there have been people here. And as you say, it's been for a very long time that there have been people in Australia.
Let's take a look at the role that hunting played with first settlement. I would presume that there would have been subsistence hunting, but as well as sport hunting. And in some ways, there would have been the desire to hunt as it was done in Europe.
Oh, yes, certainly. And even before European settlement proper, there's been hunting by Europeans in Australia. So Captain Cook, as he spent all his time in Endeavour River, had conflict with local people over the resources. He and his crew had spotted that there were turtles, and there's what Ian McCullman calls the Turtle War, where they captured them. The local people noticed the turtles on the deck of the Endeavour and were upset because here are their resources. Here are their resources that are important to their own survival being taken by these foreigners. Even before proper European settlement, there's European hunting in Australia.
Oh, good. Because the Macassan people came down, and well, I don't know if it's hunting, but that's more harvesting in the north.
Oh, it's commercial hunting. You're quite right. Fishing, I think, does fall into the same category as hunting, and hunting and fishing often get lumped together. It's just where the animals live. Do they live in water? Do they live on land? So, yes, there's commercial hunting that early in Australia as well.
When Europeans come to Australia, and you just mentioned with turtle, but there would have been a need for subsistence hunting very early on if they weren't able to bring the stock over with them, which they didn't necessarily have the numbers.
Oh, they struggled, and that early Sydney colony struggled for a long time. So, yes, there's pressure there from people hunting and taking those local resources because they need them to survive, and putting pressure on Indigenous people who need those resources as well.
Do you know if the Europeans took any notice of Indigenous hunting techniques?
Now, that's something I'm not sure of. They certainly note that Indigenous people are skilled hunters, but I don't think there's any particular picking up of Aboriginal hunting methods in Australia. And they are quite determined to bring out their own forms of hunting for a number of reasons. And they bring them out. It's astonishing how quickly they start imposing their ideas about hunting on the landscape. And they don't even wait till they get to land.
Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, on ships on the way over, they take pot shots at sperm whales. They go fishing for albatross. When they get really desperate, they throw bottles overboard and shoot at them. And this is all recorded in people who are writing about their voyages on migrant ships on the way out. The moment they get to land, they go and they start shooting at birds and whatever around. But they're so desperate to continue this cultural form, this cultural activity, that they're doing it on board ship on the way out, even when there aren't animals that really look like traditional prey.
So just for that's purely and for no other reason than just for the sport of shooting things?
Yes. Sometimes they do eat the things that they catch, but often they don't. And when they're fishing for sharks, sometimes they eat them, but there's a certain hesitancy among seamen, among the sailors, to eat the sharks because you might be eating a former shipmate at one remote.
We're taking a look at the significant role that hunting and the history of hunting has had in Australia. Give us a ring if you're interested. One of the things within that, Claire, though, is did we start to import animals to hunt? Because I think of foxes here, and because fox hunting had such a strong tradition.
That history of fox hunting in Australia is really fascinating. So you said, how important is it? Do they bring ideas with them? They bring ideas with them from Britain, and so that fox hunt arrives. And they also bring ideas from the wider British Empire and try to pretend that Australia is a proper part of the empire and has things that are worth shooting. There are a whole lot of complaints among early colonists that Australia just doesn't measure up, or the Australian colonies just don't measure up with the other parts of the British Empire because there aren't large exciting things here to shoot. But yes, then they bring in the animals as well to support their types of hunting. And they start those types of hunting even before the animals are present. They're so desperate to perform these particular rituals. Yeah, they have tame foxes for a while with the Melbourne hunt. The foxes are too precious to actually kill. They've brought these things in. They're desperate to get as many runs with them as they can. The huntsman actually has to scoop up the fox before the hounds can. And the Melbourne hunt also had stags that lived in a stable and would run for home. So they'd take them out, they'd release them, and they'd run back to their stables and get chased along the way.
Do they talk about recreation or sport hunting Indigenous animals here in dingo? I'm just thinking about dingoes, if they wanted to get something that would run fast, like dingoes and kangaroos, for the fun or for the sport of it?
They chased them, and they chased them all dressed up like the proper English hunt. But they tend to pretend that they're not chasing them. And if you look at the artwork from this period, depictions of the hunt, in the foreground you've got these people dressed up in the proper clothes for the English hunt. And then way off in the distance you might just catch a fleeting glimpse of a kangaroo because they're in denial. They want to pretend that they're doing the proper hunting. And they chase dingoes. Sometimes they even hunt emus on horseback in this fashion because they want to continue this. And they'll put on a hunt too where they don't have any prey animals at all.
Oh, so they just prance around in the gear.
Well, they tend to have something called drag hunting, where you have a bag that's got bone meal or something that the hounds will pick up the scent of, and somebody will ride off dragging that behind them, and then the hounds will track it, and the whole hunt proceeds as usual. And there's even a step beyond that. There's a thing called the paper chase. And the first hunt in New Zealand was without horses, without foxes, without hounds. It was this person with a bag of ripped-up paper running along, scattering it. And it's actually quite sophisticated. They'd scatter the trail depending on what the ground was like and how well it would hold scent. So if the ground wouldn't hold scent well, they'd only put a little light trail of these bits of paper so the wind could blow them away. And then other people would run along, being the hounds.
And so it was more to do with the process and the dogs than it was to do with actually hunting animals.
It's to do with the prestige. And a lot of people in Australia, in the Australian colonies, come out and they get dressed up and they hold these types of hunts because they wouldn't be able to do it back in Britain. And so it's a sign that they've arrived and they're establishing their new status. And the hunt in Britain is all about status. You know where you are and what role you can play in that hunt. So doing it in the colonies, a lot of people are doing it to say, actually, we've arrived. We're gentry now.
Well, look, a lot of the people we'll talk to will be a little bit more about recent history of hunting as well. Tom's called in. Hello, Tom.
Hi. Well, we join a national park and a forest area. And the first feral pig that I shot was in 1965 with a modified Lee Enfield rifle, 303-25, an open sight. He was high up on the banks of the dam, and I hit him in the brisket, and away he went. He went for 200 yards flat out and dropped dead. But he had huge tusks, and there used to be quite a lot of trophy hunting in those days, but you never see those pigs today. They've got them down there that have these massive incisors that for ripping things open and catching people.
Let me go back to Claire. Claire, when did we start to see trophy hunting in Australia? Because it's not something we think of here as much. Well, I don't, because I don't know much about hunting.
It's interesting, and there's kind of invisible hunting to do with trophy hunting. So the kind of hunting that Tom's just spoken about, where you go in your local area and you know your way around and you love the place, that's reasonably visible in rural parts of Australia. But this trophy hunting occurs, we just don't see it. So it occurs in Australia with the Northern Territory safari camps, which are in existence. We have safari camps in Australia. They sell experiences to wealthy tourists. It happens a lot in New Zealand, where people will hunt red deer, and they'll hunt red deer within estates. So the people know what animals are there, and they'll sell a head, they'll sell a trophy essentially while it's still on the animal. And then the overseas hunter, who's paying quite dearly for the experience, will go and hunt that animal within the enclosure. For the points, there is a rating system on trophies. The rating system that is maintained by the Safari Club International.
And some people want
prestige in getting the top-rated head for the year. And that is still going on. There is this, as I say, this invisible trophy hunting at this kind of international elite level.
There's been conversations about the legislation as far as hunting crocodiles are concerned in the Northern Territory for quite a while. And when you think of trophy hunting, then crocodiles would be at the top of the list as far as animals within Australia.
They would be. Crocodiles have charisma and allure. There's a whole lot going on making crocodiles intriguing prey. And yes, there's always chatter about hunting crocodiles again in Australia. But it's that thing about if we're doing it for the money, if we're selling licenses to these overseas hunters who will pay tens or hundreds, you know, up to $100,000 for this opportunity, what does that mean in terms of limiting access to people who actually live in the region? Where's that conflict between parochial hunting, people doing this and doing it to some extent traditionally, and that being criminalised while people can pay for the same experience?
So historically, what sort of knowledge do we have of historically crocodile hunting in Australia?
Historically, crocodile hunting in Australia, there's a bubble after the Second World War. And that's because all of a sudden in Australia, in northern Australia, there are guns which can kill crocodiles reliably. Up to that, it's really hard to kill a crocodile. They're big, they're tough. With the leftover weapons, the 303 rifles from World War II, it's possible. There's also political events in Africa, which mean that the price of crocodile skins rises sharply, and so there's profit in killing animals. And there are people who have come back from the war and aren't ready to settle down in the suburbs and want to come north and have an adventure again. So historically in Australia, that period after the Second World War is an interesting one, and there's a crocodile bubble where people do head north and do try to make a profit from having this adventure in northern Australia, hunting crocodiles.
And when do they, I presume there's legislation then that is introduced to ban crocodile hunting?
Yes, and there's rolling legislation. So there are two types of crocodile in northern Australia. There's saltwater crocodiles and freshwater crocodiles. And there are three jurisdictions that crocodiles live in, within crocodile range. So there's rolling protection across northern Australia. Freshwater crocodiles in Western Australia get protected first. They get protected in 1962. Queensland is under the Joe Bjelke-Petersen years, and so it's not until 1974 when the federal government acts that crocodiles in Queensland get protection. So there's that whole rolling protection across the north, across Western Australia, the Northern Territory and Queensland, as legislation comes through to start protecting crocodiles.
Hello, Craig.
Yeah, mate, I just wanted to bring up a very prominent Australian hunter of sorts. He was back in the year 2000, 2001, and he listed flora and fauna on the Australian Stock Exchange. He built compounds with feral-proof fences and bought up large tracts of land, put the feral fences up, and then he'd eradicate all the feral cats, which is the main predator for the bilby.
Yeah.
And this fella actually got the thing going in Easter now. You can buy a chocolate bilby, and it goes back. And so he was well known, and I'll just leave it at this for your listeners. Any cat lovers out there, you better close your ears. But he used to wear a hat made from feral cats.
I remember that. Great, thank you. How significant, Claire, was the introduction of rabbits to Australia?
They're an interesting one. So obviously environmentally they've been extremely significant, and they get everywhere, they destroy the soil structure, they eat everything. But they're brought out to Australia, and there are real efforts made to introduce them. They don't take the first lot of rabbits die out. They have to keep on trying to introduce them. And they're introduced because Australia is going to be an egalitarian society where every man can hunt. And so they're deliberately brought out to foster this idea of hunting in Australia. They're important, as I say, for their environmental impacts otherwise. And the people who brought them out, so particularly Thomas Austin in Victoria, he manages to build his reputation on them. He comes out, and at one point Prince Alfred visits him and shoots rabbits on his estate because these animals are leading to his prestige in his new society.
When you take a look at things, I mean, we've got rabbits, we've got feral pigs, we've got all sorts of, we've got deer out here. There are a whole stack of animals now that are associated as being feral, and that there are varying hunting laws associated with. But are some of those animals, as well as rabbits, like with pigs, were they brought out here for hunting or just for domestic purposes that went feral?
Deer are no good for domestic purposes. They're very flighty and they're quite dangerous. So deer farming is a very modern innovation. They're brought out, and they're brought out at staggering expense because people want to think this way about their wilderness. We do use animals to think with. And by releasing deer into the wilderness, somehow we're claiming it and we're making it something that we're familiar with. And hunters really do place weight on the importance of having deer available for hunting. This is something I found in my initial work looking at New Zealand. The idea that there are deer in the hills is very important. I remember coming across a quote from A.E. Shand of the Federated Farmers Association, who said, you know, if we have deer in our hills and we send young men in to hunt them, that will solve our urban vandalism problem. Not quite sure what solution he had in mind, but it's interesting, there's that idea that in these places, in these colonies which are judged deficient the way that the Australian colonies and New Zealand are, putting these animals into the wilderness makes them better places. And so there are these organisations that introduce them. And it's not just on the land. They also introduce fish. If you can imagine in the 19th century bringing salmon and trout from Europe to Australia, that's what people do. They put in the effort to develop the technology, develop the techniques, and get these animals that are so important to them to these new places.
Just on that, Claire, where did your interest come from as far as this research is concerned?
It comes from my background in New Zealand. You might have caught the accent by now. And it started back in 1999, where I did a project at the end of my undergraduate. And I was looking at rabbits in New Zealand, but I was looking at the debate surrounding the use of 1080 poison in New Zealand. And the debate was all about whether it would be turned on deer and how the eradication of deer would be morally bad for the country. And so interesting ideas there, which I then picked up when I came to Australia and I looked at 19th century hunting in New Zealand and Victoria.
Tony, hello.
As a lad growing up in Western Queensland, every grader driver carried a firearm. Every council truck driver carried a firearm, mm-hmm. because there were bounties on foxes, pigs and dingoes. So with the introduction of three things, the employers didn't like it anymore because there was firearm restrictions. All the free or should we say, the people who were interested in controlling the animals that did it at no charge to the community, were taken away. And since that's happened, the numbers have just gone through the roof.
So what you're equating with gun control to an explosion in feral animals?
Most definitely.
Would think that the feral animal increases aren't necessarily due to gun control.
No, hang on. The two things come with gun control. The people who carried firearms to shoot to get the bounty were no longer encouraged to carry a firearm in their workplace, and it was difficult for them to get the licenses. The bounties still apply.
Well, I'm not sure if that's anecdotal or not. We would need to actually explore those links. I don't know whether or not you've looked at that, Claire.
There's some interesting work on this from New Zealand again, and from using deer hunters, recreational deer hunters, to control numbers in certain regions. And the finding is that recreational hunters don't effectively control pest species, partly because they're doing it for fun, for pleasure, and when the species aren't there in enough numbers, they lose interest. And so those populations don't get pushed low enough to ever be properly controlled. So there is that kind of information, that recreational hunting is not in itself a great way to control them. There'd be the problem as well in terms of where there's access. So again, you know, my background in New Zealand is showing. But again, in New Zealand, there was a huge government push to get people, they paid people to go into the hills and work for a season as deer hunters, just to kill whatever they could see. When helicopters come in, they start doing it from the air. And what they notice is that the hunters on the ground really don't have much of an impact. The landscape's too rugged. They kill what they can see, and, you know, they're good hunters. But the deer just escape into these more rugged regions. Once you get up in a helicopter, you can see the populations and how this government control work is just touching the edges and not really controlling the populations at all. And it might be the same thing if your hunters are coming in along roadways because they've got their weapons in their vehicles. So they're not touching the real mother load of these feral species.
Claire, as far as recreational hunting and hunting is concerned in Australia, how much of that is affected by individual states and legislation to affect hunting, and when did we start to see those legislations enacted?
Now, that's a question I'm going to have to look into because I can't actually answer you. I'm more interested in the 19th century or in that period of crocodile hunting. And so I know access to those, to the crocodiles up in northern Australia is originally controlled by the state and then taken over by the federal government in order to get around Joe Bjelke-Petersen. But I can't actually answer that one effectively, so thank you. I'll be looking into it.
No problem. So what were some of the big issues that impacted on hunting around the time that you were looking at?
I'm really fascinated with the way that people bring in ideas about these animals and about these forms, these activities, and impose them on the Australian landscape. So with these animals being brought in through the acclimatisation societies, by the time the acclimatisation societies are established, all the economically significant species are already here. These organisations are formed to bring in these sporting species because people are so passionate about it. And I just can't imagine bringing a deer by ship to Australia, but they're doing it.
Pete, hello.
G'day, how you going?
Good, Pete.
Rather strange attitude of mind, isn't it, people have? They go to another country, but they want it to be exactly the same as the country they came from.
Exactly.
Where are you going in the first place?
No.
I mean, gee, come on, this is the problem with this country, you know. And then we create myths about how the place used to look. You know, I met people, their family came in the 1840s. Well, I'm in the Upper Hunter. By then, the country, the landscape had completely devoured of, you know, all the river flats, vegetation sort of stuff, and they think, oh, no, it was always open plain, but it certainly wasn't.
You want to talk about water buffalo?
Water buffalo was the issue I was getting on to. I mean, back in the 60s and 70s, could have gone back earlier than that, the big thing was to go into the Northern Territory and hunt these sort of ferocious water buffalo. And my brother-in-law and some of his father and other family members went up the top end, come back with the sale. It's like shooting cows. He says, I don't know what's so ferocious about them. I mean, they just stand there out in the bloody, in the landscape sort of stuff, and if you wanted to shoot them, you know, you go on a local property and just pop a cow off them, and it's no more difficult than that.
So. See, that's a lot of the thing, Claire, is that whether or not, I mean, that's one of the great debates of whether or not it's actually a sport or not, and water buffalo hunting was quite big for a period of time.
It was, and the commercial hunters did have a hard job. So if you read Tom Cole and his account of hunting and hunting buffalo in the Northern Territory, he's racing along on horseback trying to shoot them, and he shoots them in the spine because he can't kill them outright. The people who are processing them have to come up later while they're still alive, otherwise things will get into the meat and they're no good. So he's racing along on horseback at speed over uneven ground, and it does sound dangerous and adventurous. But then you read these other accounts, which are exactly like that one, of these things just stand there and they're calm. But I think hunters need to believe that things are dangerous and difficult. And you see that a lot in the writing about hunting, that people are promoting how adventurous and dangerous it is. And you do have to take it with a grain of salt. But at the same time, hunters get killed. Deer are quite dangerous. Pig sticking and pig hunting, dogs get killed an awful lot. And so there are dangers involved with these species. And this is why those big, charismatic animals are so attractive, why safari hunting is in this kind of category of its own, why people desperately wanted these big, exotic species in Australia.
What sort of accounts do they have of hunting and what is considered to be game hunting in Australia, as in written accounts?
There's a whole lot of memoirs from people who settled in Australia early, and often they've come via India and by the larger British Empire. So they'll write about it, and they will write about it in comparison to where they've been, and often they're retiring military men, so they're writing about getting into quite remote areas in India and then how disappointing Australia generally is. When there was that crocodile bubble in northern Australia, some of the people who were doing it for adventure, and so they're writing about their accounts, and there are memoirs of that. Oh, this is a really important part of their life, and so they're self-publishing memoirs as well about their times hunting.
Gary, hello.
Good morning. Well, I've got a question for Claire about the history and introduction and potential hunting of camels in Australia.
Claire?
Right. I have a colleague who knows an awful lot about, actually I have two colleagues who know an awful lot about camels. I think his view is that the Burke and Wills expedition were not absolutely the first to introduce camels to Australia, but they're important in that process. And so camels are amazing technology and have been amazing technology for humans for a long time in terms of being able to go through difficult country, go at speed over long distances, carry heavy weights, not need water and care in the same way that horses, for example, do. So camels come, and they come to Australia because of their usefulness. And they're brought certainly for that expedition from Melbourne up to northern Australia. And they keep on coming after that. They're associated with the empire in India and with those handlers, the Afghans. And when Australian immigration policy catches up with people and expels people, they're attached to their camels. They love their camels, and so they'd rather set them free than kill them.
And thus we had feral camels, and then we would start to find out about camel hunting.
Yes. And there are significant populations of camels now in Australia, as I'm sure you're aware.
Mm. Thank you, Gary. Peter, good morning.
Yeah, how are you?
Good, Peter.
Yeah, no, I like your topic. But what it is, I'm a bit upset about, they tell me the parks and wildlife, they're shooting deer from helicopters and just leaving them on the ground. Now, I don't think that's right. The thing is, they're a majestic animal, and the thing is, they should be respected as that. And the thing is, if they want to harvest them, why not harvest them with have chillers and export the meat overseas or local consumption or something like that? But to shoot something and leave it on the ground, that's not the idea of shooting to me. You know, like, well, years ago, my grandfather, used to shoot rabbits, they used to drive them in the corner and they come out of the top of the fence. That's how thick the rabbits were. But what people don't realise in the Depression years, that's what fed this country, you know?
Look, thank you, Peter. There are a couple of, look, there are a whole stack of issues, and this is something that we may take a look at in a separate occasion, Claire, and actually dealing with feral animals and how to do it humanely. And we'll take a look at that in a different occasion. Wayne, hello.
Yeah, I went hunting with David Gelpel up in Arnhem Land, and I found the pigs and the buffalo far more dangerous than the crocodiles.
Yeah, that's probably true. thank you. And we tend to between them, we tend to speak crocodiles with a lot more respect, Wayne.
Yeah, well, they were the only mob that were known as the crocodile eaters, the people in the northern Arnhem Land around Ramagini, around the Arafura Swamp. And grandmas, if they were out fishing and they come across a crocodile, they'll hell-bent for weather with spades or anything to try and get that crocodile.
Wayne, thank you. Look, and this is a conversation for another time, which we'll take a look at, is Indigenous resources and Indigenous hunting at another occasion. Russell, quickly.
I heard someone mention about leaving animals on the ground. Most of the countries, it's impossible to get animals out of anyway.
I'm with you, because you could actually hunt them by helicopter, but getting into them is probably more difficult.
This is right. I was a deer cutter for 10 years in New Zealand for the New Zealand Forest Service.
Okay.
They used to provide me with food and ammo, either parachute, pack horse, or a helicopter later.
Russell, thank you. Clint, did they take a look at introducing, do you know, any other animals, but they then didn't introduce them? I mean, if we wanted to go hunting, why didn't they introduce big cats? Or maybe they did. That's the ones that escaped.
They talk about a whole lot of stuff. They really do. Monkeys are a big one that they talk about. And private acclimatisation domains are fascinating. So George Grey over in New Zealand on this island off near Auckland, he introduces two zebra. And his monkeys are going quite well. So he's brought them across. And suddenly they're talking about bringing monkeys into Australia because they'll entertain travellers. His monkeys are going quite well, but they tend to cluster in a tree near his house and make a lot of noise early in the morning, so he shoots them all.
And did they look at introducing zebra for hunting?
The zebra didn't go so well.
No.
One of them broke its back on arrival, and there is a zebra skin rug in the mansion house on Cow Isle, and I wonder whether that was that particular zebra. But they introduce all sorts of things, and it's not just to the colonies. The Acclimatisation Society in Britain wants to have herds of eland roaming the Salisbury Plain. So these great, whacking, big African antelope, they're thinking that they could improve Britain.
They're amazing in the things that they thought of. It's been great talking to you this morning, Claire. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Claire Brennan, lecturer in history at James Cook University.